You speak up. Here comes Democracy Now.
Perfect.
Without their little free.
From New York, this is Democracy Now.
We searched approximately 364 properties in the Altadena area, and unfortunately, during that search, we did locate three deceased. As these searches continue, I unfortunately anticipate that those numbers will increase.
Devastating wildfires in Los Angeles have killed at least 24 people, with dozens more missing. As the region braces for more dangerous winds, we'll talk about the historically black Altadena community, where Octavia Butler, the writer, is buried. It's been ravaged by the fires. We'll speak to Los Angeles journalist Sonali Kohatkar, who had to evacuate her home, and California climate researcher Leah Stokes. Then to Gaza, where Palestinian journalists are criticizing the lack of support from international media organizations.
We are just documenting a genocide against us. It's enough after almost a year and a half. We want you to stand foot by foot with us, because we are like any other journalists, reporters, and media workers all across the globe, no matter the origin, the color, or the race. Journalism is not a crime. We are not a target.
We'll speak with Palestinian reporter Aboubakar Abed in Gaza. Then, as Poland reverses course and says it will not arrest Prime Minister Netanyahu under the ICC warrant if he attends the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz this month, we'll go to Brussels to the Hind Rajab Foundation. It's leading the effort to hold individual Israeli soldiers accountable for war crimes and making it very difficult for IDF soldiers who fought in Gaza to travel outside Israel. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The death toll from the fires in Los Angeles has risen to 24, with dozens of people still missing. More than 12,000 homes and other structures have been destroyed or damaged as firefighters continue to battle the Eaton, Palisades, and Hearst fires. Los Angeles County Fire Chief Anthony Marone says the risk of new fires remains high.
Elevated critical fire weather conditions will continue through Wednesday. Please rest assured that your County of Los Angeles Fire Department will be prepared. These winds, combined with low humidities and low fuel moistures, will keep the fire threat in all of Los Angeles County very high.
The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and Los Angeles County have both declared public health emergencies due to the smoke and particulate matter from the ongoing wildfires. Meanwhile, the Mexican president, Claudia Sheinbaum, has sent a team of Mexican firefighters to Los Angeles. Laura Vasquez Azua is the head of Mexico's civil protection.
We will stay as long as necessary. We will support in a spirit of solidarity and with all our experience and commitment to the people of California.
As of Friday, nearly 1,000 incarcerated firefighters have also been deployed to help fight the L.A. fires. According to state officials, the incarcerated firefighters are paid a daily rate of between $5.80 to $10.24. That's a daily rate. Meanwhile, many wealthy residents in Los Angeles are hiring private firefighters who cost as much as $2,000 an hour to protect their property. Authorities in Gaza say more than 5,000 Palestinians were killed or went missing in the first 100 days of Israel's siege on northern Gaza, which began in early October. Another 9,500 Palestinians have been injured and 2,600 have been detained. In a statement, Gaza's government media office said, quote, in the past 100 days, our people in northern Gaza have suffered the most horrific forms of killing, ethnic cleansing, destruction, and displacement, unquote. This comes as talks continue over a possible ceasefire and hostage deal. Reuters reports Qatar gave Israel and Hamas a final draft of a deal earlier today. President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke on Sunday. But Israel's continuing to attack Gaza. Earlier today, Israel bombed a school in Gaza City, killing 5 displaced Palestinians. On Saturday, Israel struck a school in the Jabalia refugee camp, killing at least 8 people, including 2 children and 2 women. On Saturday, a funeral was held for the Palestinian journalist Syed Abu Naban, who was shot dead by Israeli forces Friday. He was a freelance cameraman for the Andalou news agency. This is his colleague, Mohammed Abu Namous.
It is clear that the Israeli occupation wants to target the journalist body that exposes its crimes. While the occupation has utilized its media to say that they only target the resistance and their weapons until the Palestinian journalists have exposed the truth to the world, saying this occupation targets children, women, and unarmed civilians.
Meanwhile, the government of Poland has adopted a resolution to protect Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu from arrest if he attends a major event in Poland this month to mark 80 years since the liberation of the Nazi concentration camp at Auschwitz. In November, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Netanyahu for war crimes in Gaza. At first, Poland said it would honor the warrant and arrest Netanyahu if he came to Poland. On Friday, New York judge Juan Merchan sentenced President-elect Donald Trump to an unconditional discharge in Trump's 2016 election subversion hush money case. This means Trump will avoid jail time or probation despite being convicted by a jury on 34 felony charges. It also means Trump will enter the White House as the first president with a felony conviction. This is Judge Merchan.
After careful analysis, in obedience to governing mandates and pursuant to the rule of law, this court has determined that the only lawful sentence that permits entry of a judgment of conviction without encroaching upon the highest office in the land is an unconditional discharge, which the New York State Legislature has determined is a lawful and permissible sentence for the crime of falsifying business records in the first degree.
Donald Trump appeared before the judge remotely and criticized the sentence.
It's been a political witch hunt. It was done to damage my reputation so that I'd lose the election, and obviously that didn't work. And the people of our country got to see this firsthand because they watched the case in your courtroom.
In other Trump news, special counsel Jack Smith has resigned from the Department of Justice. This comes as Trump continues to fight to block the release of Smith's final report on his criminal investigations into Trump. Senate confirmation hearings for Trump's nominees begin Tuesday when the Senate Armed Services Committee considers Pete Hegseth, the Fox News host tapped by Trump to become defense secretary. Hegseth will likely face questions over accusations that he raped a woman in 2017 at a Republican women's conference in Monterey, California. He claimed the encounter was consensual, but he later paid the woman as part of a non-disclosure agreement. Hegseth's own mother has called him, quote, an abuser of women, unquote. Also on Tuesday, confirmation hearings will be held for Interior Secretary nominee Doug Burgum and Veterans Affairs Secretary nominee Doug Collins. The U.S. Supreme Court appears poised to uphold a law that would ban TikTok starting January 19th and lets its Chinese parent company ByteDance sells it to a U.S. buyer. Backers of the TikTok ban claim the popular social media app, which has some 170 million users in the U.S. alone, is a national security risk. Critics of the ban say it's motivated by anti-Chinese sentiment and warn it threatens the livelihoods of many content creators and small business owners who rely on TikTok. In more Supreme Court news, the justices agreed to review the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act's no-cost coverage for a number of preventive care services, including some cancer screenings, HIV prevention drugs, and heart statins. Sudan says its military has recaptured the key city of Wad Madani from the paramilitary rapid support forces. Wad Madani, the capital of Gezira province, fell to the RSF over a year ago. The devastating 21-month civil war has killed over 28,000 people and displaced more than 11 million. The UN says famine in Sudan has now spread to five regions with over 750,000 people on the brink of starvation. Meanwhile, Doctors Without Borders announced Friday it's suspending operations at one of Khartoum's main hospitals after its workers repeatedly came under attack. The Prime Minister of Greenland says he's open to dialogue with incoming U.S. President Trump, but maintained Greenland is focused on its independence amidst Trump's continued threats to take control over the territory. This is Prime Minister Mutta Beaya.
The desire for independence, the desire to be in one's own house, is probably understood by all people in the world. And that struggle from Greenland's side isn't new. It didn't just happen yesterday. It didn't happen when I give the New Year's speech. But things have developed in that direction for many, many years, at least for many decades. We don't want to be Danes. We don't want to be Americans. We want to be Greenlandic. And of course, it is the Greenlandic people who decide their future.
Trump's threats towards Greenland have shown a spotlight on the territory's push to gain full independence from Denmark, which has long been accused of committing colonial abuses against its mostly Inuit population. In Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro was sworn in for a third term Friday in a ceremony held 5 months after a controversial election that the opposition claimed to have won. A number of Latin American leaders skipped Maduro's inauguration, including Luis Inácio Lula da Silva, the president of Brazil, and Gustavo Petro of Colombia. The inauguration ceremony was held a day after the Venezuelan opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, was briefly detained. As Maduro was sworn in, the Biden administration announced it would offer a $25 million reward for information leading to Maduro's arrest. The Biden administration's extended temporary protected status for immigrants from Venezuela, El Salvador, Ukraine, and Sudan for 18 months. The relief shields people from deportation, though it doesn't provide a path to citizenship. Immigration officials have postponed a planned check-in with the New York immigrant rights leader, Ravi Ravier, who feared he could soon be deported. The check-in, which was scheduled for today, has been pushed back until mid-March. This comes as Ragbir is seeking a presidential pardon before Biden leaves office in a week. Visit democracynow.org to see our interview with Ravi Ragbir on Friday. The Justice Department concluded the 1921 Tulsa race massacre was a coordinated military-style attack as the agency released the findings of its investigation announced last fall. On May 31 and June 1st of 1921, white rioters murdered an estimated 300 black residents of Tulsa, Oklahoma's Greenwood neighborhood known as Black Wall Street and looted and destroyed their homes and businesses. The report also states there are no living perpetrators for the Justice Department to prosecute. The last remaining survivors of the Tulsa race massacre, Viola Fletcher and Lessie Benningfield Randall, both 110 years old, have been seeking justice and reparation for years. Last year, the Oklahoma Supreme Court dismissed their case. A Columbia Law School professor who vocally defended students after they faced persecution from Columbia for protesting in support of Palestinian rights says she was terminated after 25 years on her job. Catherine Franke accused Columbia's administration of creating a toxic and hostile environment for debate and of failing to protect its students and faculty. Columbia was at the center of a firestorm around campus protests for Gaza last year after it violently cracked down on student demonstrations, called in the New York police to dismantle a peaceful encampment. Former Columbia President Manu Shafiq, who last year also gave a disastrous congressional testimony on Capitol Hill, ultimately resigned. UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese decried Frankie's termination, saying she was, quote, yet another victim of the pro-Israelism that is turning universities and other spaces of public life into places of obscurantism, discrimination, and oppression, unquote. To see our interviews with Catherine Frankie about this case and more, go to democracynow.org. And the founder of the Young Lords, Jose Chacha Jimenez, has died at the age of 76. In the 1960s, Jimenez turned a Chicago street gang into a Puerto Rican political organization inspired by the Black Panthers.
So the Young Lords were a gang in the Lincoln Park neighborhood that first came in there and was being beaten up by other existing ethnic gangs at first, and felt the need to organize. So they were a gang. And then in 1968, we reorganized. I was the president of the group then, and I kind of led. I was a catalyst for reorganizing the group into a political movement, modeled after the Black Panther Party, because we wanted the same concept, but in the Puerto Rican community.
After starting in Chicago, the Young Lords would expand to New York and other cities. Chacha Jimenez also worked closely with Black Panther Fred Hampton before Hampton was assassinated by the FBI in 1969. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Los Angeles, where at least 24 people have been killed in devastating fires that have scorched and flattened entire communities over the last week. Dozens of people are still missing. The fires have burned over 40,000 acres and forced some 150,000 people to evacuate, while an estimated 12,000 homes and other structures have been destroyed or severely damaged. This is Los Angeles County Sheriff Robert Luna.
Yesterday, we started a search and rescue operation out in the Eaton area, where in the first day of this operation, grid searching, we searched approximately 364 properties in the Altadena area. And unfortunately, during that search, we did locate three deceased. As these searches continue, I unfortunately anticipate that those numbers will increase.
Firefighting crews continue to battle three active blazes in the Los Angeles area, making progress over the weekend against the two biggest fires, Palisades and Eaton. But authorities warn of a new wave of strong winds expected to return to the area this week. Los Angeles County Fire Chief Anthony Marone says the risk of new fires remains high.
Elevated critical fire weather conditions will continue through Wednesday. Please rest assured that your County of Los Angeles Fire Department will be prepared. These winds, combined with low humidities and low fuel moistures, will keep the fire threat in all of Los Angeles County very high.
As of Friday, nearly 1,000 incarcerated firefighters had also been deployed to battle catastrophic fires, working around the clock, with some making as little as between $5.80 to $10.24 a day. Meanwhile, wealthy residents in Los Angeles are hiring private firefighters who cost as much as $2,000 an hour to protect their property. Mexico has also sent firefighting personnel to help contain the L.A. fires. Laura Vasquez Alzua is the head of Mexico's civil protection.
We will stay as long as necessary. We will support in a spirit of solidarity and with all our experience and commitment to the people of California.
This comes as the U.S. Health and Human Services Department and Los Angeles County have been both declared public health emergencies due to the smoke and particulate matter from the ongoing fires. Despite that, many schools located outside mandatory evacuation zones are scheduled to reopen today. For more, we're joined by two guests. guests. Sonali Kohatkar is an award-winning journalist and author and host of the radio and TV show Rising Up with Sonali. Her forthcoming book, Talking About Abolition, A Police-Free World is Possible. She's in Pasadena and had to evacuate. And Leah Stokes is with us, an associate professor of environmental politics at the University of California, Santa Barbara, researcher on climate and energy policy. We're going to go first to Sonali. Sonali, we spoke to you last week just after you evacuated your family, your parents, your kids. Can you talk about what you went through this weekend? Is your house still standing? And what about your community?
Thank you so much, Amy. I appreciate that you had me on. In the midst of my evacuation, I last spoke to you from a hotel I had evacuated to. Friday morning, I returned to my home with my family. I am one of the lucky ones whose home is still standing. My husband and I went and checked on it. This house was very well sealed, and my elderly parents, who are disabled, it was very hard for them to remain evacuated. They hadn't showered in days, and their house, which is right behind mine, is relatively new. So we made the decision to bring them back. And, you know, had been covering the every square foot we could with air purifiers in our house, wearing respirator masks until the air indoors subsided and the quality increased and improved. We had to make sure that we were stocked up on bottled water because we were being told that out of some caution, the water should not be consumed for any kind of drinking or brushing teeth. So we had to make sure we had enough water. And it has been, you know, the air inside smelled of smoke for a while. Now it's subsided quite a bit. We're staying mostly indoors, although I've been walking around my community and trying to capture the stories of people who've lost everything. On Friday afternoon, already there were crews of young people who were kind of deputized, if you will, by the Pasadena Job Center, which is basically a day laborer center here in Pasadena, to go around and help people clean up debris. People in Altadena, so I live like 1.5 blocks south of the border with Altadena. That border is being completely barricaded and policed by local law enforcement, the sheriff's department, and National Guard. And so anybody who wanted to go into Altadena to clean up couldn't. So North Pasadena sort of benefited from their volunteer efforts. A crew of young people came into my backyard, cleared up all the debris, and bagged it in 2 hours. So that helps mitigate any future danger from fires that we might expect this week. I mean, it's been quite remarkable to see my community rise up. There's donation centers popping up spontaneously every couple of blocks. But there's also this grim reality, you know, where I'm driving west on Woodbury Avenue, and on the right, there are law enforcement standing, just preventing people from going. And on the left, there's members of the community who are helping one another. And those are such starkly different realities. And, you know, there's a curfew in place in Altadena and the evacuation zone. So anybody who's caught walking outside in Altadena after 6 p.m., even if they live there, is being arrested. And every day those barricades are coming further and further and further, one block south into North Pasadena. So it does feel like we're living in a war zone. There's remarkable resiliency, but there's also this grim sense that, you know, it could happen again. My concern is no one's really strongly linking what's happening now to climate change, because my house may have survived this round of Santa Ana winds. What about the next round next week? Or what about next year and the year after that? So yeah, it's been strange. I'm so lucky. I now know 23 people and counting who have lost their homes. People I saw just days before the fire, and now who have GoFundMe pages set up. It's very devastating.
And can you talk about the community of Altadena, the historically Black community where Octavia Butler is buried?
Yeah. She's buried just a couple of miles from my home. I visited her grave last year. My book club read Parable of the Sower because her book, you know, was written in the 90s, but it opens in July, I believe, is summer 2024. So we sort of read it just a little bit after that. And it is so prescient because it is a post-apocalyptic Southern California around Los Angeles. Octavia Butler called this area her home. The cemetery she's buried at, Mountain View Cemetery, is just on the Altadena side of the border. I drove by there yesterday. There seemed to be a little bit of damage, but the reports that I'm reading, because I still can't go in to Altadena, are that the cemetery was by and large not too damaged. There's a lovely, amazing Black-owned bookstore in North Pasadena called Octavia's Bookshelf, run by Nikki High, a Black resident of Altadena, who has turned her bookstore into a hub, a local hub of donations. I interviewed Nikki. She hasn't even been back home. She thinks her home is standing, and she has just risen up for her community. And she, I spoke yesterday with Perry Bennett, the owner and proprietor of Perry's Joy, a beloved institution in North Pasadena, who was telling me about the tight-knit Black community in Altadena and Pasadena. And you're right, you know, Altadena is home to about 18% of its population is African-American, so a little bit higher than the general country. And it's, you know, Altadena is a town that was rapidly gentrifying, but that Black community has stayed there for generations. I can count, you know, friends who have lost their family homes. And it's a very tight-knit community. Perry Bennett was telling me yesterday how everybody knows everybody else. Everybody knows their moms and dads and you know, neighbors. And then I encountered four young Black women who were giving away, who had set up a donation hub on someone's front lawn. And they were incredible women who had grown up in North Pasadena, Altadena. Some of them were now going to college elsewhere, but they had come back. Their families were impacted. It's a tight-knit community. It's a community where people have had the chance to own homes because they hadn't been redlined historically. And the people are grieving, wondering if they can rebuild those networks. There's developers already circling around. You know, predatory capitalism waits for no one. Yeah. And they are offering people, you know, offering to buy up their property already. And it's insulting. I mean, the embers haven't even gone cold. The smoke is still rising and the developers are circling.
As Naomi Klein wrote about the shock doctrine, the rise of disaster capitalism, I wanted to turn to the science fiction writer, Octavia Butler, on Democracy Now! Back in 2005. You know, she writes about global warming, about totalitarianism. We were one of the last interviews with her before she died and was buried in Altadena. We spoke after the catastrophic Hurricane Katrina.
I wrote the two parable books back in the 90s, and they are books about, as I said, what happens because we don't trouble to correct some of the problems that we're brewing for ourselves right now. Global warming is one of those problems. And I was aware of it back in the 80s. I was reading books about it. And a lot of people were seeing it as politics, as something very iffy, as something they could ignore because nothing was going to come of it tomorrow. That and the fact that I think I was paying a lot of attention to education because a lot of my friends were teachers, and the politics of education was getting scarier, it seemed to me. We were getting to that point where we were thinking more about the building of prisons than of schools and libraries. And I remember while I was working on the novels, my hometown, Pasadena, had a bond issue that they passed to aid libraries. And I was so happy that it passed because so often these things don't. And they had closed a lot of branch libraries and were able to reopen them. So not everybody was going in the wrong direction, but a lot of the country still was. And what I wanted to write was a novel of someone who was coming up with solutions of a sort.
Prophetic, the Black famous writer, Octavia Butler, back in 2005 from Pasadena, buried in Altadena. As she talked about prison, Sonali, what about the incarcerated firefighters? We went out to California, interviewed them years ago, now making what, between $5 and $10 not an hour, but a day as they risk their lives like other firefighters to fight these blazes.
Yes. Yeah, and, you know, there's not very many media outlets that are bringing up that aspect of the firefighting effort in Eaton Canyon and Palisades and all of the fires that have broken out. It is, to me, so indicative of the ways in which our spending priorities are so skewed. Yes, it's true that our fire departments are severely understaffed. So instead of us, you know, training more,